WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Tonight in New York, saxophonist and composer Ornette Coleman will perform the last of a four-concert retrospective as part of the Lincoln Center Festival of Exploratory Music, Dance, and Theater. This celebration of Ornette Coleman is just one in a series of recent honors. He was awarded a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant in 1994, and this year he was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we're offering our own tribute to Ornette Coleman. We'll hear from Ornette and his son Donardo, and from two other musicians who played with Ornette, Charlie Hayden and Don Cherry. Today, Coleman's standing as an important jazz innovator is unassailable, but as a newcomer in the late 50s, he was a controversial figure in the jazz world. His band at the time, the Ornette Coleman Quartet, was so rhythmically and harmonically radical that it provoked an uproar among musicians, critics, and listeners, who all jumped into the fray to attack or defend this new music. This is how the group sounded in 1959, playing Lonely Woman from the Ornette Coleman album, The Shape of Jazz to Come. The Ornette Coleman Quartet, performing Lonely Woman on the 1959 release The Shape of Jazz to Come from Atlantic Records. It features Don Cherry on trumpet and Charlie Hayden on bass. Charlie Hayden's impact on jazz was both profound and immediate. In 1959, he moved to New York from Los Angeles to become part of the quartet. In 1985, he told Terry Gross about his first encounter with Ornette.
I was 19 years old, and we played all day long, and he had a room full of music strewn all over the floor, the walls, the ceiling. He was constantly writing music, and he told me before we started to play, he said, "Charlie, I've written these pieces now, and here's the chord changes. Now, these are the chord changes that I heard inside myself when I was writing the melody, but these are just a guide for you. I want you to be inspired from them and create your own chord structure from the inspiration or from the feeling of what I've written. And that way, constantly, a new chord structure will be evolving, and we will be constantly modulating, and we'll be listening to each other, and we will make some exciting music." And that's exactly what happened.
Were you surprised at how controversial the music was when you started playing it? You know, a lot of people couldn't handle it at all, musicians, listeners.
I was very involved in learning about the playing. We were all involved because it was a brand new language. We didn't even think of it as being a brand new language. We only thought of it as we're hearing something and we got to play it. And we were constantly learning about what it was we were doing. Things were being born every day out of what we were doing. And there was a lot of controversy around us. When we opened up at the Fight Spot in New York, fights used to break out right in the club. People would be putting us down. People would be praising us. The club was packed every night with everybody from different parts of the art world, painters, famous writers, filmmakers, dancers, musicians. I would look out, and standing at the bar would be Paul Chambers, Percy Heath, Charlie Mingus, and they would be looking dead in my eye, you know, and saying, "Okay, what are you going to do?" And I would be playing and have my eyes closed, and one night I opened my eyes and there was Leonard Bernstein with his ear glued to the front of my instrument. And I looked over to Arnett and said, "What is this?" He says, "I'll tell you later." And then we were invited to Leonard Bernstein's table. He invited us to the Philharmonic rehearsals, and he couldn't believe that I was self-taught, and he wanted to try and get me to study music. And he was very helpful in me getting a Guggenheim Fellowship 10 years later in composition. But it was like that every night. It was very exciting. The violence wasn't exciting. I mean, one guy set somebody's car on fire one night, I remember. Somebody came back in the kitchen. We were standing talking with Ornette, and I won't say who it was, and hit Ornette in the face, you know. I mean, it was really a very strong excitation time. New things were happening, not only in music, but in people's minds every night from that music, you know. And people were always asking me why I was the only white musician, and I never thought about that until people asked me about it, you know. And but that's the way life is. That's the way human beings are.
Charlie Hayden, bassist in the Ornette Coleman Quartet, from a 1985 interview with Terry Gross. We'll be hearing a more recent interview with Hayden in the second half of our show. In the 1960s, Ornette Coleman led a revolution in jazz. We'll hear from him in a few minutes. At his side during this time was the trumpeter Don Cherry. Cherry died in 1995 at the age of 58 of liver failure caused by hepatitis. He spent the first part of his career in the 50s and the early 60s with the Ornette Coleman Quartet. Terry spoke with him in 1990.
When you played with the Ornette Coleman Quartet at the Five Spot in 1959, the music you were playing was considered very revolutionary. And some people really loved it, and other people thought it was, you couldn't even call it jazz.
Right.
Would you share one of your memories of what it was like then to be in the middle of all this controversy?
Yes, well, what's interesting about that is that when we came to New York in the winter of 59, everyone came from Leonard Bernstein to Thelonious Monk. And like you say, some people loved it and some people hated it, didn't like it. And there would be arguments and fights, and a lot of different scenes have happened. And I remember one night Charlie Mingus bringing Phineas Newborn. And Phineas Newborn has perfect pitch. You know, you can have relative pitch or perfect pitch, and he had perfect pitch. And Charlie Mingus wanted him to play with us. And there was a piano there, so Charlie Mingus had brought Phineas Newborn to set in with us. And we started the set, and Charlie Mingus set Phineas Newborn in front of the piano. And the whole set, we had played four or five tunes, an hour set, and Phineas just stood up there and looked at the piano while we were playing and didn't play a note. And at the end of the set, Mingus came up on the bandstand while Phineas was sitting there, and he took all his elbows and hands and put all the notes on the piano. Like that. And he said, that's where it is. It's all there.
Is one of the reasons why Ornette Coleman didn't use a piano in the quartet of the 60s because everybody was playing slightly off-key intentionally, you know, slightly sharp or whatever, and a piano was tuned, and you couldn't get between notes on a piano.
And you're saying, yeah, the tempered is a tempered instrument.
Tempered, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And actually, this is something else I've learned, and it's funny how certain things you're involved in and you don't really understand, but you feel it's of value, and later on in years you understand. From studying Indian music again, we realized there's 36 notes in an octave in Indian music. And the semitones, the minitones, are called shrutis. And pitch is one particular reason of not using the piano, because of us working with tones and not just notes, and the different ways of tuning. But one of the reasons of not using the piano, I can also see, is the freedom of a percentage of improvisation. What I'm saying is that you can improvise and go in more directions by not having a piano. If there is a piano player that has the ear enough to know the voicings and can be able to voice it in a way where that you can hit those in-between tones or voices that would, which I know Thelonious could and Abdul Ibrahim Dollar Brand can.
You used to play in unison with Ornette Coleman on the themes. So it would be trumpet and alto saxophone in unison. But it wasn't the kind of like polished simultaneous playing. You both had tones that sounded like cries in a way. Tell me a little bit about how you'd rehearse and what you'd be going for when you would play in unison on the melody.
Yeah, that's interesting because now he's really working on something called harmonic unison. But at that particular time, we would learn the compositions frontwards and backwards. And he would write a composition and I would play the melody, and then Ornette would play with me and write a harmony to the melody. And it's funny, in the harmonic concept, it ends up that when that happens, the harmony that he had written or put with the melody that I was playing would end up being the melody. And the melody that I was playing from the beginning would end up being the harmony. So like an example of that is when we would play with Dewey Redman and myself and Ornette, or Dewey Redman's a saxophone player from Texas that is really fantastic. He's one of the few musicians that really knows the harmonic concept. But it was a period when we would play together, and Ornette would write a third part, and I would be playing the melody, then Dewey would be playing maybe the harmony part that Ornette had written from the second voice, and then he would write a third voice, and it would end up where the third voice that he would write would end up being the melody, and the other two parts that we would play would end up being the harmony.
Don Cherry, speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we continue our tribute to jazz artist Ornette Coleman with an interview Terry Gross recorded with the man himself and his son, drummer DiNardo Coleman, in 1995. They spoke following the release of Tone Dialing on their label Harmelotic, named after what Ornette Coleman calls his harmelotic approach to music. DiNardo produced the recording. Here's the opening track. What did free jazz mean to you when you were young? You know, when you were a child.
It didn't mean anything to me.
It just meant more music?
No, wasn't even aware of it. I was not even aware of free jazz or any categories. You know, like I said, to me it was just a natural sort of experience, just, you know, playing music with my father and other guys that were playing with him. And, you know, I made some records and I would actually go and play some performances, and that was it for me.
You know, when you say free jazz, I feel the same way. I never told anyone I was playing free. In fact, I went to a promoter had hired me to play in Cincinnati, and he had posted around the city a free jazz concert by Ornette Coleman. And the night of the concert, about 5,000 people showed up, and not one had bought a ticket.
Well, they thought it was free jazz,
yeah,
right? No,
yeah.
No admission. DiNardo, can I ask you to share your earliest musical memory of hearing your father's music?
Probably playing together. You know, I think I expressed an interest in playing when I was really young, maybe 5 or 6 or 7. And I wanted to play the drums, and so he got me a drum set, and we just started playing together. And for me, yeah, that's really how I became a musician or learned, you know, what music was about, was just actually playing and listening and being in the environment as, you know, they were rehearsing And all the people that played with him, you know, particularly the drummers, really were my influence, like Ed Blackwell and Billy Higgins, Charles Moffett. So I was just really right there, you know, in the environment. And again, it wasn't so much saying I really wanted to be a musician as I really just, you know, wanted just to participate. And
why drums? Why did you ask for drums?
You know, I don't know at the time. That was just what I expressed interest in. You know, I don't really remember exactly why, but it just captivated, you know, my imagination at that time.
Arnett, I think the reaction a lot of parents have when a child asks for drums is, couldn't you have asked for a quieter instrument? Did you ever have that reaction yourself?
No, because I think I suggested him to play the drums. I told him, you know, forget about how someone is seeing you through their own eyes or their concept of who they are. Just enjoy what you like doing, whether, you know, I don't think anyone has to please someone in order for them to enjoy what they like to do.
When DiNardo started to play drums, did you think that eventually you'd be in a band together?
Well, actually, I love your questions, because I really feel very bad that I've taken up more of DiNardo's time for him to assist me in what my needs are in relationship to a composer and a performer, because basically DiNardo has his own expression and his own music, and in some way he has put that on the back burner to assist me and his mother.
Do you feel like you've done that too, DiNardo?
No, because, you know, I feel so much a part of what we've done together that to me it's been the same thing, you know, although there's some other things that, you know, that I've been thinking about trying to explore, which is going to be part of some of the other records we're going to be putting out.
DiNardo, when you started playing drums, did your father have any rules about around the house about when you couldn't practice because it would bother the neighbors? You know, the typical drum problem.
No. Although I remember once when we were practicing, like, in the garage. At that point, we lived in Los Angeles.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't know if the neighbors complained to somebody, but there would seem like a whole battalion of police showed up one day. And they were very aggressive.
And they pulled their guns.
They pulled their guns?
Yeah.
I think they were surprised to see, you know, him and I just in the garage rehearsing. I don't know what they were expecting, but, you know, I do remember that.
Did you ever find out who called the police?
No. But, you know, I don't really remember anything else in terms of, you know, being restricted, though.
Well, I guess that taught you a lesson of how angry people could really get. Jeez, I guess it taught you a really different lesson, though, about the police.
Yeah, well, you know.
I don't think it was music. I think it was racial.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Ornette, remember you said earlier that you sometimes feel bad that you feel like you've maybe limited DiNardo's options because you've needed him to work with you in the band and managing you and all that. In what sense do you feel like you need DiNardo, that he's doing something that someone else isn't going to be able to do for you?
I love your questions. Because those questions sound to me are psychological, social, and racial, and everything else. But basically what I was referring to is the fact that I read in the paper the other day where a brain specialist, as a guy went in the hospital and say, this leg is going, this is the leg I want you to take off. Do you know the right leg? And when he woke up, it was the other leg that was taken off. So for me, I would rather work with someone that know what I'm trying to achieve.
Right. You know? You feel like with a lot of people, they misunderstand you.
No. I said to know what I'm trying to for instance, I had an interview with a very good critic in Europe last week, and he said, oh, you know, this music, I really love what you're doing, but I don't understand it. I said, well, I want to ask you a question. If you did understand it, would you love the music better? You know.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Terry, do you play music or sing?
Oh, I've played a bunch of things badly.
Oh, that's what I thought.
Yeah,
I mean, I didn't think you played them badly, but I thought you must be connected to music.
Yeah, no, but yeah, I've played piano badly and French horn badly and clarinet badly, and even a little bit of guitar badly.
Next time we play, and bring either one of your instruments. to our rehearsals. Maybe we could find something good.
Hey, I sing really badly, too.
Oh,
this sounds great. Say I did that.
Yeah.
What would the first thing be? What would we do?
Well, we would first ask you to do something that you enjoy, that you feel you do well. Then we would play with you.
Oh, that's interesting. So you just kind of play around me.
Well, actually, you know, I was going to ask you if you were a composer. I could give you an example of just how our musicians that I asked to do what I'm asking you to do would feel more comfortable doing that. Because, for instance, you know, maybe you have a favorite key or a favorite, for instance, the Bach piece on the record.
Mm-hmm.
When I was looking for a classical guitarist, I had asked Chris Rosenberg which piece did he like, and he said, oh, I like this piece by Bach. I said, well, play it. Then after he played it, I said, you know, I'm going to take my horn and interpret what you're doing harmonically. And when I got through, he said, I want to join your band. So I said, that's just the reason why I did this, so you could see why I'm interested in hiring a classical player. Because if you listen to that piece on the CD, you will see that he's playing it twice, and the second time he plays it, he sounds like he's playing changes for us to play to resolve harmonic ideas. And when he's playing as a solo piece, it sounds like a melody.
Mm-hmm. Although he hasn't changed.
He hasn't changed.
The way
nothing
he's playing
changed.
It,
not
both
at
ways,
all.
He's playing the same
so
thing.
So you
ways.
Could do that with us very easily, mm-hmm. even if what you call bad.
Ornette Coleman and his son Donardo spoke with Terry Gross in 1995. Tonight, Ornette Coleman performs tone dialing with his band Prime Time at the Lincoln Center Festival. Ornette Coleman's new album, Colors, is coming out in August from Harmelotic Verve. This is Fresh Air.